Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connection's Monday edition. Today's date is December 8th, 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me again for this installment of the French Connection's informational broadcasts. We are in a deep mess here, ladies and gentlemen. It's happening quickly. It's happening worldwide, but principally the United States is losing every qualitative thing that was ever said about the United States is fast melting away, turning into a despotic and poverty-stricken continent, North America. And I couldn't be more heartbroken about the outcomes here. The worst part, I guess, is that most Americans are still really oblivious to the facts that we have uncovered here on the French Connection, which I must say is partially due to the indoctrination the Americans have been under for the last 30, 40 years. You know, the educational system in the United States is about consensus building, not about education anymore, not about reading, writing, and arithmetic any longer. It is about how you get along with somebody, how you don't argue, don't stand up to authority, all of these things. These are goals of the educational system that have been actually described in white papers, and one of the principal authors of this new way of teaching sheeple, or creating sheeple, was put together by the RAND Corporation, a Zionist-controlled criminal think tank that has been very well known for many years. But aside from that, we've been exposing the second leg of a criminal gang here, this Lubavitch, Shabbat Lubavitch, their worldwide reach and tentacles going into almost every major nation in the world and certainly all of the principal nations. You know, I pointed out in the last show that all of the people who think Russia is free of Zionist Jewish control have a rude awakening when they do some research. And, of course, none of the so-called truth seekers are willing to go down this road because it seems on the surface that Russia is an ally of the truth, but in fact there's nothing that says they are, except that, you know, getting rid of a couple of the multi-billionaire oligarchs who are from the Jewish community, allowing them clearly to keep their billions, but turning over the same control over to the central structure of communism, which is still alive and well in Russia, central planning, central control, central everything, and then do a little bit of research beyond that, and you'll find out that Orthodox Lubavitch rabbis are all over the leadership of Russia. They're present in every major city. They're involved in every major problem, and if you just dig a little bit, you'll find that to be true as well. So keep your eyes open for the facts instead of what people tell you, like Alex Jones and the rest of these crackpot, lying, controlled opposition types. But I'm going to bring up my guest today. We're going to talk a little bit about historic events and about things that we've uncovered in his book. We go back a long time. We were publishing things like the Rothschild timeline some 4 or 5 years ago, putting that out into the world when everyone was telling us that this would get us killed. It was a scary time to be pushing the envelope, ladies and gentlemen. But you know what? As time has passed, not thinking that they couldn't still do exactly what we worried about, but the fact is, so what? The truth and the future of our world is more important than the risk involved, because, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, in either sense, we're in deep trouble. If we expose them or we don't, we're in trouble. So we might as well just throw caution to the wind and fight back. I mean, you know, a lot of people out there are afraid to stand up and show themselves to be against these people, but I urge all of you just to throw caution to the wind and fight, like my guest Andrew Carrington Hitchcock has done from London. Andrew, are you with me?
Yes, thank you for inviting me on the show again, Daryl.
Well, it's great to have you back, Andrew. You know, as usual, you're one of my favorite interviews, because you know the genesis of our research has come about almost in parallel here. You know, we both started out learning some of these facts together. I mean, and none of it's been easy. It took research. It took It took trusting sources and then having to realign ourselves after we made mistakes. And, you know, there have been a lot of mistakes. There's a lot of people out there, Andrew, that are trying to send us down the wrong road. Have you experienced that yourself?
Well, yes. I think that certainly when I started my research, I thought that when I was doing the Rothschild timeline, that would just be a Rothschild element, and then there'd be Bilderberg Group element, and then there'd be, I thought it was basically a bunch of industrialists that were, their only desire was money, and there was nothing else, and there was no sort of link to religion or, as we found Zionism or anything like that. Just thought that was one element, but as I got more and more into it, I found that that was the one controlling force.
Well, yes, because history starts proving that to you as you start making your links back in time to Frankis, to Jabotinsky, to the revolutions in Turkey and in Russia at the same time through Carrasco and the rest. But so what it shows you is that these people are very well organized. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely, and it also shows it's not a recent thing. This is just they're in a difficult situation because in order to attain world domination, which is what they want, as they get more and more power, their power is going to become more and more obvious. And so the key is to expose it as it is coming about, which is what you do very well on your show, and to join the dots. And I guess that my timeline that became the book is just joining the dots together, and then it makes perfect sense.
Well, it does, and it makes it easier for people who are novices or newbies to this research. To your book's easy to read, Andrew, and one of the things is you don't have to pick it up and read it cover to cover to start getting a full sense of the conspiracy. You can pick out any time frame, any time period, and it'll begin to show you that we're not nutters for making these connections. And in fact, if you just suspend your disbelief long enough, you'll understand that this is actually the facts about how our world is run. One of the things that I have discovered over time is that we had a group called the Frankist movement, which was developed out of this Sabbatean movement, which a lot of Jews rejected. A lot of people in the Jewish community were Torah Jews, and they believed in a Mosaic law and the Ten Commandments and so forth. And it wasn't until this real virulent Talmudic Khazarian Zoharite group started taking their full control that we started seeing actual fights within the Jewish community. And that, I think, culminated in World War II when they figured out a way to get rid of their opposition and blame it on somebody else. Am I fair to say that?
Yes, Darrell, I would agree with that. And also, the other aspect of World War II, that it was really that convinced a lot of Jews worldwide that they always had to stick together.
Yes, yes.
And that was another important element of this, because then this group can hide behind a race and say that if you criticize them, then you're racist because you're criticizing the race.
Well, wouldn't it be a parallel to say that I can remember John Gotti in New York City, right? He down in Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn, he would throw block parties and pay for them. I mean, John Gotti was a big mafia kingpin. What he would do is he would buy, he would shut down a whole big boulevard and pay for a huge circus and carnival to come to the community every year, foot the whole bill for it. And, of course, if you needed an operation and your kid, you didn't have any medical coverage, John Gotti would give you the money. Well, needless to say, in his region, in his area of Brooklyn, he was a hero. Now, this guy was also out there killing people for trash contracts and cement contracts and every other thing. He was as bad a human being as you can get, murder, pillage, plunder. But yet, in his home community, he was seen as a great hero because his generosity was very well placed. Well, let's expand that to a global sense, and we can see what Zionism has done here by incorporating the faith of many Jews and bringing them into the fold. But I have to tell you, one of the things I'm seeing, Andrew, is that The Jewish community can't any longer make believe they don't see this. I mean, it's got to be obvious to them what these cretins in Israel are doing. It's got to be obvious to them what their Mossad has been guilty of, and the fact that America is falling to the complete control of these people. They can't not see that anymore. Am I fair? Is that a fair statement? Because I mean, maybe I'm too close to the information, and I see it so easily, but it seems to me these people should be able to see it by now.
Well, yes, and I think that the interesting thing here, something that I read recently was, I think it was a member of the Gambino family who was trying to set up the Italian Defence League, much like the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, is for Jews. The idea was that he could say that anyone who criticised him as being mafia was anti-Italian. And we know historically, if we look back at something like the Anti-Defamation League, that was just what criminal Zionism used to hide behind.
Yep.
And we know with the mafia that the real people at the top are the people like Lepke and Siegel that were all Jewish anyway.
That's right,
So they weren't going to let this, I do believe it was a member of the Gambino family, he basically got shot in the head and he was on a life, well, it was basically brain dead for, I think, about 15, 20 years before he actually died. It was because he wanted to set this up, because they thought, oh, we can't have that happening, because we can't now have an Italian Defence League, we only need to have a Jewish Defence League. So it's what's good for one group of people, but not for others.
Well, it's interesting, too, because these same people set up the Southern Poverty Law Center, which was supposed to be a champion of black civil rights, but only up until recently it was headed up by a Jew, a non-black. And it's very clear that if you know, anybody knows anybody in the Jewish community in New York, they don't mix with blacks very well. They'll come out in defense of them, but you know, they're in the background, they're very much called Schweitzers and the rest of it. But here's the interesting thing: this guy Morris Dees, the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center, is very well connected to B'nai B'rith and the ADL, and they were involved in Oklahoma City bombing up to their eyeballs with this guy Strassmeyer and so many others. I mean, this information's been around now for a decade or more, and you know, again, you get Jewish Zionist fingerprints all over a major murder spree and bombing, fake false flag terrorism in America.
Well, yes, and the Southern Poverty Law Center is interesting there. It's also the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, that was set up in 1910, 1915, something like that. And it wasn't until the 70s that they had a black president, and all the presidents prior to that were Jewish. And I think the Southern Poverty Law Center, I mean, what it promotes is people being in poverty. It actually wants people in poverty to come to them. And they set up in areas where you do get a large black population, and I think that what they've the Zionists have always tried to do with their immigration policies into different countries is to bring another race in and then stir up hatred between the people that were the natives of that country and the other race that they brought in.
Mm-hmm.
And so people end up fighting amongst themselves while these people operate in secret behind the scenes. And you know, it's indicative of the Mossad motto, by way of deception, thou shalt do what?
Well, you know, it's easy to, you know, what you need to do basically is just foment some fights between people, and people are always going to run behind their brethren or their race and say, oh, the blacks are against the whites, the Latinos are against the blacks, and it's so easy, divide and conquer strategy. It's a very simplistic strategy, but it's used because it works so well. And does it work in Britain as it does in America?
Well, yes, I think that the interesting thing that makes me think, and it's a bit of a tricky point, but if, I mean, say in Britain we've got, I live on the outskirts of London, and you'll have, say, a mosque, then you have a Catholic church, then you have a Protestant church, then you have a Hindu temple, all these different things, and it just doesn't make, it's just chaotic, really, rather than when people were in countries that were of the Muslim faith or were of Hindu faith and what have you, of course the country was shaped to that faith. And so with that in mind, it was better for them because the country represented what they wanted. And now, because they've moved people around the world, they then have to provide services for those people around the world. And rather than just, you know, rather than just keeping things simple, they complicate things.
Well, the multiculturalism is actually a tool of these people. And one of the easiest things to do, and this has happened in France, and I want to bring this up because I think it's probably a parallel in Britain. They brought in the lowest class group of Algerians here. Algerians who in Algeria could not afford very much. They were poorly educated. They were backwoods, backwater people with very basic values from the countryside. Now, that in itself isn't bad. What they did was they brought them into France for kind of like a low-wage slave labor in the factories. Now, this was back in the 1970s under Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. They built up a very large minority of Algerians in the country over a 20-year period, 30-year period. Then their children got here, and they offered them the poorest schools, the worst opportunities, and then had no way of these people ever getting good jobs when they graduated high school. And I've seen this firsthand, where the best student in the entire high school sent resumes to everywhere in France and couldn't get a job, which this girl was brilliant. And so ultimately she just stayed in school because it was the only place that would accept her because her grades were so good, but she couldn't get a job. Now, my point is this. What they did is they emotionally impoverished the place she lived. They physically impoverished it. They whipped drugs on it, so like they did in the ghettos of the United States, and then they created a racial derision, and then they pointed to this group and said, look how bad they are. In other words, they set this group up over 15, 20 years to be bad guys, and lo and behold, they were. And what the result was is that on the TV set every night in their controlled press, they badmouthed this group as being to blame for their own lot. But if you take a look at history, they were driven into this mess. And it's very interesting because what ends up happening is that people who have no contact with the Algerian community have a hatred for this group because they say, you know, they're destroying my France. But if you look at the policies over the 30-year period, it was designed this way. And I can tell you the Pakistan population that was brought in, put into these consul houses and have difficulty finding upward mobility and jobs, and then blaming them for their own failings when they don't have opportunity, it makes the whole country divide from this group and hate them. Now, this is a very tried and true, well-tested system because they did the same thing to the Turks in Germany. They did the same thing to the Moroccans in Spain. So these people are working off of a play card or a dance card here, Andrew. What do you think?
Well, yes. It's, if you look at in America, of course, you know, America was founded. We had immigrants from Germany and England and Italy and Ireland, and it was all sort of essentially Christian in nature. So they all went over there, and they had that single, you know, that single sort of mentality that I guess you would call Western roots, heritage, what have you. And then Senator Jacob Javits changes it all in the 60s to say, no, we can't have, what he basically said is we can't have anyone white coming in. That was what he said. And he wanted all these other races to come in. That was how they basically do what you just described there with the Algerians. And and then create a division amongst the population.
Well, but they've done it so well here in France that you've watched on your television screen as these very poor consul blocks, we call them Le Bagne here in France, have exploded in riots. But I'm going to tell you something. I have known people who's lived in these areas. They have 28 to 38% unemployment, depending where you are, and the jobs that they do get are minimum wage, called minimum insertion SMEEK. They don't have any money. And so the fact is they're living a permanent life of poverty, and it's done by the decisions of politicians intentionally. And you know, Do you blame people for being angry about this? You know, they're invited in to be laborers at nothing, and then they don't give them a chance to become part of the society. That's pretty unbelievable. But when you understand the reason for it is to create hatred toward Islam, so ultimately now we can turn Europe against the Islamic countries. It's about fomenting a wider world war against Christianity and Islam, and it was done by Zionism. It was done by the Jews. Jacob Javits did it from America. The Sarkozy group and backwards into time, the same people. You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, and also, in Britain, it was 1965, it was Frank Suskis, another Russian Jew there in government, that he was the Attorney General. And he passed the Race Relations Act, which was basically what they do is they bring the people over, and then they segregate them, and then they gradually merge them into the society, because they know it's going to create friction because of the different beliefs that these groups have.
That's right.
Whichever way you look at it, you know, I mean, for example, a Christian and somebody who believes in Islam, they can still, you know, get on, they can
yes.
be peaceful and what have you, but there are always going to be fundamental differences that, you know, God is Allah, and we know God is, that's God's not Allah.
Yeah, but you know what, I got to tell you, Andrew, the kindest people I've met here in France, kindest ones, nicest ones, we lived in a council block with my wife. When I first got here, my wife's apartment was in a very difficult neighborhood, and it was all almost all Muslims around me. And they were very kind to me and my wife, generous during holidays, helpful when we needed it, protective of us when we were out. In other words, they were very nice and they were generous. And I found this to be part of their character. Now, at the same time, the youth generation were angry. And I would see, now we went, one of the members of my wife's family married somebody from Islam. And we would go out dancing in nightclubs in the city of Lyon. And everybody would get into the club except her husband. They wouldn't let him in.
Mm.
They would stop him at the door and say, "You're not permitted in this club." And, I mean, they would do it right in our faces. And we'd stand there dumbstruck saying, "Holy Toledo, you can't do that." Well, guess what? They were doing it everywhere. And it went on for decades like that. You couldn't get into restaurants. You couldn't get into a good school. You couldn't get a job. I mean, this is policy stuff. I mean, stuff like this is, you know, outrageous. And yet, they do it. Now, I'm, you know, sitting here knowing what the full conspiracy is, that they'd like Christianity to hate Islam and fight it in a wider war, and then have these puppet masters over on the side playing the race card constantly, it has worked all the way until now. And now, for the first time, I think, people are starting to wake up to the idea that, well, maybe, you know, maybe radical Islam was fomented by Jews. Wahhabism was invented by them, by Jews.
Well, yes, and again, when you said about younger generation then having hatred, it's because the stories that are told to them by their parents that were, you know, first generation immigrants, if you like, are of exclusion and, you know, in some cases assault and, you know, all manner of discrimination that they suffered. And so the younger generation think, "Oh, right, now we've got to take it out on whitey," and that could be the attitude.
Well, and then if it's helped along with vitriol and...
Exactly.
Yeah, now here's the interesting thing, okay. We've got these same people, these same Zionist Jews worldwide in their Lubavitch centers worldwide, like Mumbai right now, if you've done any research. They're behind this attack, and they did it in conjunction with some criminal Hindu sect that they're supporting, but of course it was orchestrated by Israel. And of course immediately it blamed on Islam and Muslims in Pakistan. But all the evidence is pointing to the fact that it's done by Mossad.
Well, yes, and I think it's very interesting that Nariman House, that Jewish center, there, bombarding the media with that young child and his parents were killed and what have you. Well, there's no I very much doubt that story. I think that it's a classic situation of showing Israel as being a victim again, because their victim status is legendary, and that's how they, you know, who us type of thing. So I believe that that's where it was orchestrated out of.
Yeah.
All the hallmarks of a Mossad operation. We don't, you know, if the media tell you, oh, a lot of Jews were killed there, well, that's just what the media tell us. There's no evidence that there were. You know, they'll line up the coffins in Israel and they're saying, oh, this, we're going to bestow an honour on the woman who was the babysitter for this family who was Indian herself when she's got a Jewish name. So, you know, the whole thing is very, very suspicious.
Well, look at the Levant affair. Go back into the 50s and watch as they put on the Arab garb and went out and tried to commit terrorist acts in Egypt and got caught. And they've been caught doing it in Amman, Jordan, red-handed. And they've been caught worldwide. Abu Nidal was an agent of the Mossad, proven. And, of course, he was killing everybody in the 70s. I mean, come on. Yeah.
And then we've got the dancing dancing Israelis with all their Arab clothing.
That's right.
In 9/11, you know. So time and time again, what I say to people is, the worst thing that you can do is believe mainstream media. Occasionally they do slip up, like when they announced that Building 7 had come down on the BBC 15 minutes before it actually had. They got their synchronicity wrong there.
Yeah.
But, you know, look and see what's going on, and then work out who benefits. And the good thing, I guess, and the reason that my thinking got shaped is that I think most of us out there, most of the listeners, have got a brain, and it's very simple to just look at history and look what happened historically, and then it's the same pattern over and over again.
Well, they stayed with tried and true methods, and you know, somebody pointed out to me that there are a lot of parallels between 9/11 and this Mumbai massacre, because the chief investigator for the FBI, who was actually bringing out the fact that Israel and the Mossad were involved in 9/11, John O'Neill, was killed on 9/11 and murdered, brought to the building and done in, and so were the people working with him. So you see the same thing about the chief investigator in Mumbai, who put the links together between the Mossad and previous attacks. Him and his whole staff are murdered.
Yeah, exactly. And with the O'Neill business, of course, I think there are other people that we've not heard about that they got rid of in 9/11, because, of course, for months they had these so-called art students over from Israel, which were basically... Yeah, it's going to take a long while to wire up that building with explosives to bring it down the controlled demolition, which is what they did. And it's going to take months, and they were in and out of there for months on the weekend, I believe.
Yeah.
Basically putting the bombs in place.
Yeah.
Because it's a massive building, and you've got to do that on pretty much every floor.
Well, they pulled over that van on the George Washington Bridge and tested it for explosive residue, and it was loaded. And, of course, all the people involved in all of that they arrested a bunch of Israelis, and they shipped them back to Israel.
And that was under the orders of Chertoff.
Well, that's right. And
it's the same thing with like the Bin Laden family that were here. They grounded every plane on that day, apart from one that flew Bin Laden's relatives.
That's right.
Because they knew that they were going to use them as a scapegoat. So, yeah, it's very simple just to look at historical events, and that gives you, you know, I think the saying is, those who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat the mistakes in the future.
That's right.
So we need to learn from the past. We need to not expect the BBC or CNN are going to tell you what happened, because they're not. They're all run by the same group, and they're run as massive disinformation operations. And unless you want to know who won in the ball game or what have you, that's all they're really good for. So, you know, but you're never going to be told the real truth about, you know, world events, because they don't want you to know. They, ideally for them, I think that they had a plan, but I think part of it sometimes, I think part of them would have liked to sort of, you know, get different groups, ethnic groups, to actually get along, because in the end they do want a world government, a world currency and what have you. And I think part of it, they might have thought of that attitude, but their ultimate aim is world control.
Yes, it's about power and profit and control. You're exactly right, and you know they do have their non-Jewish henchmen that seem to think that by going along they're going to be enriched as well, and temporarily that might be true, but wait till the hammer drops and see who they get rid of out of their own organization. It'll be the non-Jews that go marching off the cliff.
Well, there's a lot of talk about this Amero now coming in the United States to replace the dollar when that finally goes pop.
Yeah.
Whichever way you look at it, I mean, if they can't go to a world currency straight away, then they'll just do the stepping stones approach. So then we'll have the euro now, we'll have the Amero over there. Then there'll be another crisis, and they'll say, we just need one currency now because it's all done electronically.